about 4:15, so we'll get started with this group and see if people trickle in. What I would like to start with is a short prayer, and it is the first paragraph of the text of Augustine's Confessions. I will try to change the language into a little bit more politically correct language for us. So let us pray. Can any praise be worthy of the Lord's majesty? How magnificent the Lord's strength! How inscrutable the Lord's wisdom! Humanity is one of your creatures, Lord, and our instinct is to praise you. We bear about us the mark of death, the sign of our own sin, to remind us that you thwart the proud. But still, since we are a part of your creation, we wish to praise you. The thought of you stirs us so deeply that we cannot be content unless we praise you, because you made us for yourself, and our hearts find no peace until they rest in you. Amen. That is the famous phrase of Augustine, you made us for yourself, and our hearts find no rest until they rest in you. And I thought that would be a good way to start. Before we dive into talking about Augustine and his confessions, I would like to briefly introduce myself. My name's Heidi Gaiman, and I teach theology and ethics at Hartford Seminary, which is in Connecticut. That's a long way from here. Also, I am not Lutheran. Feel free to bring your Lutheran insights into Augustine. I'm sure you will have many, but I don't necessarily come at Augustine from that perspective. Now let me just mention a few details about today and the week. The first of which is that the bookstore has the text. It doesn't look exactly like this, but it is the same translation, a fabulous translation, if you're interested in doing any of the reading. Not required, but it's a great book to have on your shelf if you would like to buy it and take a look at it. I'm going to talk about Augustine today from the perspective of one theme, which is the restless heart, which we just read a little bit about. And for the coming 5 days, there will be other themes. On Tuesday, it will be sin and evil, then friendship, conversion, and happiness. And I have kind of assigned chapters to each week, just working through the first 10 chapters of this 13-chapter book. But the themes really reach throughout, and so that was just a bit of a guide if you would like to do some of the reading. How I will proceed, though, is to talk a little bit today about Augustine, who he was, and what the confessions are, and then jump into the theme of the restless heart. And I want to draw you into the conversation, and I will try to do that in part by reading very short sections of the text so that you don't feel like you need to have done the reading, and then ask you to kind of think about your own spiritual journey in light of Augustine and how he describes his own spiritual journey. So hopefully that will draw all of you into this conversation. And then finally, with respect to introductions, I'd love to have all of you introduce yourselves, but it's a little short on time, so hopefully we can do that afterwards personally. But I have a short quiz for you, and the first question is, how many in the room are Lutheran? And how many non? Okay, so that's, you know, we're holding strong, we non-Lutherans, only two outnumbered here. And are you here because of the theme or because of Augustine? Who is here because of the restless heart theme primarily? And who is here primarily for Augustine? You don't have to know why you're here, so feel free not to vote. Let's see. How many of you know something about Augustine? A lot of you. I figured there would be some background. How many of you have read the Confessions? Aha, one. Well, I'll turn to you for all my...
I've dished him, so you're on your own.
Nice. Good one. And that was the last question. I just wanted to get a sense of who you are, why you're here with respect to this particular topic. So let me just jump in. And I may talk a little bit at the beginning here at length, and then hopefully we can get into some of the the ideas that Augustine presents in his first few books. First of all, the name Augustine, some people pronounce it Augustine. I don't know that there's any particular authority on that, of which is proper. I just call him Augustine because that's what I've gotten used to. So I don't know how to answer that question. But he was born in 354 of the Common Era in Africa, in a small town called, I never pronounce this right, Thagaste. I think that's the pronunciation. It's a small town in what is now part of Algeria. And he had a father whom he names in the text named Patricus. He was not a Christian. He was a pagan, kind of a small businessman. And he was very attentive to Augustine in the sense that really tried to provide an education for him. Both he and his wife wanted to make sure Augustine had all that he needed to succeed. His mother, Monica, plays a large role in Augustine's life. She really looms large in this text, although interestingly enough, she is not named until much later in the book, and I'm not sure why that is, but she does play a primary role. She is a Christian. She presses Augustine to follow that path, and he sees her really as the voice of God in his life, and he describes her that way. So it's a very interesting kind of a non-sexist part of Augustine, who some people consider to be very much a misogynist. So he really holds his mother in high esteem, and she was really central to his own spiritual journey. A few more details about Augustine's life, very briefly. He studied and taught in Carthage. He was a rhetorician and a philosopher. He also taught in Rome and Milan. He studied law in the end. And he did return then to Africa after his mother's death, and he was persuaded at that point to become a bishop. He did not want to. He had finally made his full and wholehearted conversion to Christianity at that point in his life, and he really wanted to live the monastic life in a community of friends and worshiping God. But he was kind of strong-armed in a way, you could almost say, into being bishop, and he took that role very seriously, and hence he has become a great father of the church. And he has a few very important writings that many of you might know about. One called The City, the first one is called Confessions, which we are discussing. The City of God was also an important work. And then he wrote a book on the Trinity that is, and these texts are still widely read and thought through and argued about in the academy. And he also has many other books and letters. He was a polemicist. He argued for a certain version of Christianity against a lot of the heresies of his day. He has many letters and sermons that have been preserved. So there's a lot of writing out there if you want to pursue some reading in Augustine. He also, this last bit about his personal story, I guess his broad history, he had a son named Adeodotus, and he stayed with the mother of his son for 15 years, although they were never married. She wasn't somebody who was appropriate for him to marry, but he was very committed to her, and in particular to his son, and they stuck together as a family for 15 years until he felt like he needed to convert his life to a very serious monasticism, and then he dismissed her with much tears and regret, I have to say. But she was not his wife, but a big part of his life. Her name never appears in the book. So that's another interesting bit of this writing from that century, I suppose you could say. He died in 430 CE, so at that point the Vandals were laying siege to the city of Hippo where he was, and they came to North Africa, and he lived in a very tumultuous period of history. Rome had been sacked of 15 years earlier? 410, I believe, and he felt very concerned about the movement of history and the movement of Christianity. Now I would like to just talk a little bit about who Augustine really was. And we can ask that question in part because we do have this book called The Confessions, which many people talk about as if it's the first autobiography. It is a personal and spiritual autobiography. He tells very passionately and intensely the things going on in his mind, and in that sense it was very unusual for that period of time. But you do have some other texts, philosophical writings of people who were trying to conform their lives to certain ways of life, that wrote personal journals and that sort of thing. For example, you have Marcus Aurelius's book, The Meditations, that he's trying to guide his own life by a particular philosophy, and he writes about how he tries to do that. But Augustine really tells some of the details of his own inner life. And so it's a very passionate, philosophical, theological, spiritual story. So it can be read in very many different ways. And I welcome you to approach it however you choose. There's still many things being written about this text, arguments about which book is most important, which is the key to understanding the whole, and that sort of thing. So the scholarship goes on. But one's perception of who Augustine is can influence how you read the book, because it's not a book written in the modern sense. You need some mode of interpreting it, because he's got so many different styles of writing. So you might read it. Go ahead. You have a question?
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
So, by the way, feel free to stop and say, no, what are you doing, or I don't get it. So feel free to interrupt. He is understood as a saint of the church, and you might read the text coming into it from that perspective. He's also understood, especially by himself, as a big-time sinner. And you will definitely read a lot about that in this text. He's a misogynist, many might say, and he has been read from that perspective and harshly criticized for some good reasons, for other reasons that I would say are not as legitimate. He was a father. He was a mystic. He was a monastic. He was a bishop. You can read it from all these different perspectives, and the list can go on. And in fact, he was all of those things. But the book is written from the perspective of after he became a bishop. And so you can think about the book again with the understanding of what his own purposes was for the book. And again, the list there can go on. He was a bishop, and he took his role as a leader very seriously. So you might want to read the text as somehow a guide to draw all of us in to the same kind of searching spiritual journey that he goes through in this text. You also might read it just as he starts at the beginning with that prayer I read. The entire text can be read as a prayer, and throughout it is peppered with questions, questions, questions to God about, why did you allow me to do this? Was it my own decision? What made me do it? Could it have been that all along you were leading me in this direction? Why did I refuse to listen to you, God? And he continually talks to God throughout the entire text. So you can read it from all those different perspectives. Some of the details about the text are disturbing. For example, he never names his concubine or the mother of his son. That really bothers some people, and it's hard to get past. Other people I know, I did an adult education segment at our church, and one of the men in the room said, he barely mentions his son. Where's his son? She said, I was reading the book looking for this conversation or commentary or reflection about his role as a father and how he brought his son along with him or didn't. Wasn't there. I couldn't get beyond it. But in fact, he very deliberately took his son with him and included him in his group of friends, took his son everywhere. But he doesn't write about that. He doesn't mention the name of his friends, some of his friends, until later in the text, friends who were central to his life. So you have to kind of keep reading and see what he has to say, and some of the stuff he just doesn't talk about. For example, he doesn't say much about his son. But we do know from letters and that sort of thing that he was very devoted to his son, and he was very loyal to his son's mother. So it's hard to get past some of the stuff, but it's a text from the 4th century, so give it a chance. That would be my invitation. Now, basically today, what I would like to talk about is the theme of the restless heart. And that theme comes up, as I noted, in that first paragraph that I read to you. And it is a theme throughout the book. And for Augustine, he had a very restless heart. And again, what we're reading is his own interpretation of his past history. We all know how that goes. It can be that he's reading a lot more into certain aspects of his life or describing who he was from a later perspective that may not match up with reality, but as he sees it and as he sees himself, he was driven to find something. He was driven to find love. That's one of the things he talks about. And he knows that he's not finding it throughout. And he has numerous conversions, and conversion is another theme for later in the week. But he always feels like, this isn't quite it. I don't quite have it. What am I looking for? And because he is the person he is, he dives very passionately and deeply into, you know, the next thing he finds that he thinks is going to be what fulfills him, what gives his heart rest finally. And so the theme of the restless heart, I think, is something we can all relate to. And so what I would like to do is to work through some of the passages of the first two books of the text. And I'll read short sections to you. Not all of them will have to do with the theme of the restless heart, but we'll keep bringing that back in and see where we are when we get to the end of the second book. The first two books really cover his life from... Basically, he starts with life in the womb, at the end of the second book, we have him brought up to about 16 years old. So his whole childhood is the story of his whole childhood is told. So let me just ask you immediately what you think about that starting of his text. I read the prayer. I'm calling it a prayer. It's the first paragraph of the book, and he ends the first paragraph with, "You made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you." And then he goes on to say, "Grant me, Lord, to know and understand whether a man is first to pray to you for help or to praise you, and whether he must know you before he can call you to his aid. If he does not know you, how can he pray to you? For he may call for some other help, mistaking it for yours." Why do you think he starts this personal narrative in this way, with a praise to God and then questions about how we can even know who God is or to even ask God for help?
How old is he when he was writing this?
Let's see, it was written in 397. Have it figured out. He was relative. He wasn't that old. Let's see, 354. Yeah.
44.
I would just think that the notion of praising something, but then also doubting it. I mean, if he's coming from a background of where, if he was very influenced by his mother being Christian. It's the same thing really with all of us, you know, we are born, if we, you know, grew up in the religion that we are in from birth, it's almost automatic and natural to believe this thing, but then as you get older and you start to form your own personality and an intelligence about something, you start to maybe question it, so you praise it, but you're wondering, wait, why am I actually doing this? So that's my interpretation of that.
My guess would be that he has very much the same dilemma that modern man has when dealing with the education one would have picked up in one's churches. and then went to college and found out about science. Because the other thing that Augustine dealt with is that he's credited for having incorporated Plato's philosophy into Christianity. So what he would have been struggling with was the Plato's Plato's definition of knowledge, which was the escape of the illusion of our senses to a higher insight. And so he would have been struggling with, how do you know that you know what you think you know?
He has very strong philosophical questions about knowledge and the being of God, and if God is a material, I mean, this is part of his whole conversion experience, if God's a material being, where is God?
Yeah.
Where can I grab a hold?
Yeah.
And if God is not material, then what is God?
Yeah.
And so, he has this way of reflecting on, you know, he feels some sense of certainty, but then he wants to continually say, but what exactly do we know here?
Yeah.
How do we? And he has, I mean, we won't go into the most of the philosophical stuff, because it's a little too abstract, but he has questions about time and memory and language that is actually kind of a precursor to the modern turn to language and how everything is interpreted through language, and that makes it a little bit more difficult to say you have a grasp on the truth. And he's already kind of thinking this way. How do words connect us to reality?
Mm-hmm.
And so he's asking those questions.
I also hear echoes of somebody who is converted more than somebody who grew up in it, because I've had conversations with a friend of mine who converted kind of like post-high school. And for me, it's so, you know, our experience is so drastically different. And there seems to me some sort of deeper connection in a way, but like for me, I feel like I have a bit more distance from the whole thing because I grew up in it. I don't know if that's true of everybody, but for my friend, it's just more of like the falling into it and being really into it, and still having questions, but there's this sense that, okay, so before, how was I dealing with this and what was going on? You know, and like, there's just such a marked difference. And so I hear him saying, like, you know, when he says, how would you, can somebody who doesn't know you call on you? And it sounds like maybe he did call on like a higher power or some sort, but before he converted, and now he's kind of struggling with what does that mean now and what did it mean then and how do I connect those two?
Yeah, I think there might be something to that, because for Augustine, he did feel like, you know, he finally grasped what was true or who God was in some sense, even though, as with all of us, it's still an ongoing process of education. He finally thought, this is where the truth lies.
That question of how can we call on you if we don't know you, it calls to mind for me his wrestling with the Pelagians and the semi-Pelagians about the primacy of grace and all of that, and his steadfast advocacy, for lack of a better term, at this moment, that grace is what moves us to God, and that we don't turn to God on our own. And so I just read the first few chapters, and I can kind of, in a sense, maybe he's looking at how God's been moving throughout his life, even if he couldn't name that God at first, even if he couldn't name grace, moving him to see, to come to know God more fully.
Yeah.
I would add that the title Confessions seems to convey something of his writing, that he's making a faith statement, and the phrase faith seeking understanding seems to come through in his writing, that ultimately these things are faith statements, though he uses reason and argument. If he's a rhetorician, then he knows very well that words and structures make meaning, but praise, that's a faith decision. a faith act.
Yeah, it's a response. So in some ways you could say, well, he's starting out this book with praise to God, and then asking these questions of how can we turn to you or even ask for your help if we don't know who you are, and how can Augustine even write his own story if it's really God who's writing the story for him? So in a way, you can look at this whole text as Augustine saying, I'm writing this narrative here, but it's really God who has written me. And I'm still questioning and searching and trying to find my way through this. Let me read a little bit more here for you. By the way, this is organized, these are called books. There are 13 books, and then there's sections. So I'm going to read from book 1, section 5 now. Just briefly, he says, who will grant me to rest content in you? To whom shall I turn for the gift of your coming into my heart and filling it to the brim, so that I may forget all the wrong I have done and embrace you alone, my only source of good? Why do you mean so much to me? Help me to find words to explain. Why do I mean so much to you that you should command me to love you? And if I fail to love you, you are angry and threaten me with great sorrow, as if not to love you were not sorrow enough in itself. Have pity on me and help me, O Lord my God. Tell me why you mean so much to me. Whisper in my heart, I am here to save you. It's a little bit more of the same kind of writing at that point, where he's asking God, how is it possible that I care so much for you and that you care so much for me? And so again, you get the notion that God is doing both. God is loving Augustine, and God is causing Augustine to respond to God's love. And so again, the idea that this is really God's story. It's not Augustine's story, necessarily. He also addresses a couple other things in this passage that are themes throughout the book. He brings up the idea of rest, which he is constantly seeking. He brings up the idea of sinfulness. He has this conception of himself as this horrible sinner, and he wants to forget all the wrongs he has done, and that's a theme that runs throughout. He also suggests that there is only one source of good, and of course, I think that's not a surprise to you. And again, the idea in that little piece of who is the agent in this story? It's not really Augustine, and we can begin to see that in the very start of book one.
There's a question.
Yeah, go ahead.
What was the church teaching at that time? I mean, Reformation history, I hear all about what the Roman Catholic Church was teaching, and Luther steps in and says kind of contrary to that. Much of this must be kind of in response to or to fill a void. So what was being taught, or what did church look like when Augustine would go on? Did he go to church on Sundays, and what did that look like at that time?
I don't know if I can answer that question. I do know that there, things weren't as organized as we might think. And so there was lots of different ideas out there going on in the church. And Augustine, I think, is fairly radical in the sense of that exactly what I'm pointing out here, that God is the agent on both sides of the equation, yeah, in our own actions and with respect to God's love and grace towards us. But that's something that's relevant for Augustine in part because he is writing in response to certain heresies at the time. And some people read this text, actually, from particular theologians will read the text as partly Augustine's defense against the fact that he had been a Manichee, which is a particular religion, not a stream of the Christian tradition, but a group of people who thought that there was a good God and an evil God. And Augustine really bought into that at some point, and I'll talk a little bit more about that tomorrow. But he clearly wanted to define what he felt was the kind of core teaching of the Christian tradition as against other teachings that were out there. I'm sure when he was a bishop, he went to church on Sundays, and there were sermons. I mean, he talks about when he was in Rome, part of another one of his conversion experiences was to listen to Bishop Ambrose, who was also a church father that we know about, listening to his sermons. So he would go and hear him preach on the biblical text. So I think there was a very rich life in the church. But I, you know, I can't be more specific than that. Let me read a bit more from section six. This is where he starts his own particular narrative. We've got this section of praise and glory and questioning to God, and then he begins to describe his infancy, including talking about suckling babes and how God provides the milk. And he starts in this particular section to think about sin, because he wants to know, where does sin come from? Is it our own fault? Are we deliberately sinful creatures? And he looks even for sin in infancy, and he has this great section where he describes how, and he says, of course other people told me about this, I don't remember it, but even as a baby, he would get very jealous if his mother or one of his nurses would be suckling another child. And he has this way of reflecting in his own head, now why would I have done that? Why would I have cared if there's abundant milk for all, and yet somehow I want to snatch it away from somebody who needs it to survive, just so I'm sure I get my fair share? And he's, you know, he's interpreting his own infancy as evidence for our sinfulness as creatures. And many people really don't like that. I don't know about you Lutherans, but in my church tradition, nobody wants to talk about sin. Augustine's big on sin, and he wants to describe infancy as a clear evidence. Would you like to respond to that?
Well, it's just, I mean, as a midwife, I just think of this beautiful image of the newborn infant, right, who you can put on any mother's belly and who can find the breast and go to suckle, and to begin to think of that urge to connect to the mother and to sustain their life and learn how to do that as a sinful act, to me is just unfathomable, because it's the most beautiful seeking of life and fullness, that one of the strongest images I have. So I just,
well, one of the things I think that Augustine is very careful about is that while he often describes particular things as sinful, he doesn't necessarily want to say they're not good or they can't be good. For example, he would say that very thing is good, and it's evidence of God's good providence to care for us, that he provides milk for us through the mother, etc. It's only when it becomes the good for us, like it's mine, you know, no other babies are allowed, or, you know, whatever. An infant is obviously not thinking that, but he reads that into, you know, that urge to protect yourself at all costs is the sinful part. It's not the beauty of the mother-child bond or anything like that. And I think that actually is something that, and Augustine is very critical of the body and sex and all that sort of thing. I'm not denying that, and likely too critical. But he does always want to leave room for goods that are valuable as long as they don't transcend to the level of the good or the only good or my good. You know, it's all got to be structured under the one and only good, who is God, who then provides us with all these other goods. So it's the misuse of goods that then turns them into sin.
Because you need some language to describe. I mean, I remember, yes, it's beautiful, and when the newborn is screaming at the top of their lungs of the injustice, how do you, is that beautiful? Well, I suppose, but what language do you use to describe the not right part? And these days, sin it comes across as very judgmental, but partly, what other word do you use to describe whatever that thing is? And that's why I'm kind of intrigued by the language of sin and where he takes it.
Yeah. Yeah, he describes it in his theology as misdirected love. And in this text he would say, you know, it's looking for, you know, where our heart can rest in the wrong places. And that's when it becomes something that is not good. Well, let me read something from this section 7 of this first book. Here he's talking about this very thing, and I'll just read it quickly. I have myself seen jealousy in a baby and know what it means. He was not old enough to talk, but whenever he saw his foster brother at the breast, he would grow pale with envy. This much is common knowledge. Mothers and nurses say that they can work such things out of the system by one means or another, but surely it cannot be called innocence when the milk flows in such abundance from its source to the object. To object to a rival desperately in need and depending for his life on this one form of nourishment. Such faults are not small or unimportant because we are tender-hearted and bear with them because we know that the child will grow out of them. It is clear that they are not mere peccadilloes because the same faults are intolerable in older persons. So he's again saying, you know, we can't just dismiss this as, well, they're babies, because if an adult acted that way, we would clearly say, you know, it's inappropriate. So he's saying, we need to make this judgment. And then he concludes that section, I do not remember that early part of my life, O Lord, but I believe what other people have told me about it, and from watching other babies, I can conclude that I also lived as they do. But true though my conclusions may be, I do not like to think of that period as part of the same life I now lead, because it is dim and forgotten. And in this sense, it is no different from the time I spent in my mother's womb. But if I was born in sin, and guilt was with me already when my mother conceived me, that's a quote from the biblical text, and he does that throughout. He writes quotes into his own story. Where, I ask you, Lord, where or when was I, your servant, ever innocent? But I will say no more about that time, for since no trace of it remains in my memory, it need no longer concern me. If this is past history, why is he interested in this early part of his life? Why write so? I mean, do you know any other theologian who talks about in themselves as infants suckling at the breast and senses of jealousy among babies? And yeah. I mean, it's really kind of bizarre that it's in here. What do you think?
It kind of reflects upon what you were saying about you make an observation. We have this something in our experience that we label as sin. We have something in our experience that we label as evil. And what he is really trying to do, and as I hear it, he's trying to explore, because as you point out, the other side of it is a philosopher. So he's trying to say, where is the origin of this thing that we call sin? And he's looking at infancy and saying, is infancy... So the question is, are we born in sin and our culture teaches us to not be sinful? So that's to me what I hear him doing, is he's exploring, saying, is this the origin of sin, that when we're born it's a part of us and we have to, our religion and our society has to train us out of it? Or
was there a pure state that somehow we got out of that we can somehow get back into, or is this a part of our...
And really, isn't that really what our Genesis 1 text, in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 text is? Yeah. Man looked around and said, you know, there's evil. Where did it come from? And so, trying to label, where did this thing that we look around, and what is it, and where did it come from?
Lord, where did these weeds come from?
exactly. Things don't go as smoothly as we had hoped, and life's a struggle. Where did this come from?
Yeah, and he certainly doesn't have all the answers, because he does ask the question of, and where was I before I was in the mm-hmm. womb? Mm-hmm. And he has really no answer for that. But I think, you know, so again, it's part of this, of putting his life before God and saying, who am I? Where were you? Was I with you before this? And then where does sin come from? Because that's a big part of his own spiritual journey, is understanding the own evil, as he sees it, that he intends. You know, why was I like that as an infant? Why do I follow all these wrong paths? Who is making me do this? Is it me? And then, so he's trying to work out, I think, I mean, it's he was one of the theologians who really set the doctrine of original sin in the history of the church, because that wasn't, from the beginning, part of the church's understanding of sin.
And out of Lutheranism, and I think Luther was an Augustinian monk, and so he was versed in Augustine.
Right.
Is the notion of simul justus as et peccator, which means simultaneously saint and sinner. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand that to mean, it's trying to understand what it means to be a human being. What kind of sense do you have
right.
about the structure of human life? And what I understand that to say is that you're 100% sinner and simultaneously 100% forgiven. And that's a paradox.
Yeah.
And I think Luther, that sure sounds a lot like Luther's writing
yeah.
out of Augustine's thought about sin. And I don't know if Augustine had that notion of simultaneously sinner and saint. But for me, that's a way of understanding myself and a way of understanding you that's been helpful as a Lutheran to understand the human community and what it means to be a human.
Yeah.
Over against, say, perfectionism, that some way we can be perfect in this life.
Right.
That we can be sanctified and somehow beyond that element of sin.
Right. And that also was a definite track that Augustine wanted to squash in the Christian tradition with the Pelagius and the idea that you can perfect yourself here on earth. And Augustine was strongly against that particular view of human nature, that we can do it. That we can get there if we only try. He has a clear sense of, you know, this is all happening to me in some way, and the good is certainly not my own. It's God doing it in and through me. Well, let me just, our time's running short here a little bit, so the rest of this book one, he talks a little bit more about his adolescence, and he's kind of critical of the way he is taught in schools and that sort of thing. He feels like adults are rather harsh on him in some ways, and yet they let him wander off in other ways doing what he likes. And the theme of sin and evil come up again throughout the rest of that story. And he concludes at the end of this first book in section 20 with praise to God, even for this wit. I mean, he just describes himself as wicked. And you have to wonder, because you don't really, I mean, I don't necessarily see a lot of details that are in here about his wickedness, except that he continually says how wicked he is. And he has this idea that he doesn't study enough because he likes to play games, etc. But he concludes saying, look, even this wicked childhood is what God has given me, and he wants to focus on it as a gift from God, and here's what he says about that. And yet, Lord, even if you had willed that I should not survive my childhood, I should have owed you gratitude, because you are our God, the supreme good, the creator and ruler of the universe. For even as a child, I existed. I was alive. I had the power of feeling. I had the instinct to keep myself safe and sound, to preserve my own being, which was a trace of the single unseen being from whom it was derived. And he goes on to describe how he had this inner sense of taking care of himself, and that he gives thanks to God for that. And he at the very end he says, my sin was this, that I looked for pleasure, beauty, and truth not in him, but in myself and his other creatures, and the search led me instead to pain, confusion, and error. My God, in whom is my delight, my glory, and my trust, I thank you for your gifts and beg you to preserve and keep them for me. keep me too, and so your gifts will grow and reach perfection, and I shall be with you myself, for I should not even exist if it were not by your gift. So again, the confirmation that even this childhood that he describes as sinful and horrible is a gift from God, because it's life. He's there, and he's continuing on, and whatever good comes of it, it is God doing it through him. Thank you. And that's the conclusion of book one. Book two, he focuses again on, this is the adolescent period, and he focuses again on all the horrible things that he has done. And many people say, of course, he's exaggerating. He couldn't have been that bad. And, you know, yeah, okay, there's some stuff he describes that maybe one shouldn't have done. But I want to read just this first part to show how he describes this. I must now carry my thoughts back to the abominable things I did in those days, the sins of the flesh which defiled my soul. I do this, my God, not because I love those sins, but so that I may love you. For love of your love, I shall retrace my wicked ways. The memory is bitter, but it will help me to savor your sweetness, the sweetness that does not deceive, but brings real joy and never fails. For as I grew to manhood, I was inflamed with a desire for a surfeit of hell's pleasures. Foolhardy as I was, I ran wild with lust that was manifold and rank. In your eyes, my beauty vanished, and I was foul to the core. Yet I was pleased with my own condition and anxious to be pleasing in the eyes of men. A few more sentences. I cared for nothing but to love and be loved. But my love went beyond the affection of one mind for another, beyond the arc of the bright beam of friendship. Bodily desire, like a morass and adolescent sex welling up within me, exuded mists which clouded over and obscured my heart, so that I could not distinguish the clear light of true love from the murk of lust. Love and lust together seethed within me. In my tender youth, they swept me away over the precipice of my body's appetites and plunged me into the whirlpool of sin. Can you picture this? What's he talking about?
Boy, you have a lot of fun. Something.
Yeah, is this how you would describe your teenage years? A whirlpool.
Well, I wouldn't write about it if I were.
Right, and he tells you why he's doing this. And again, here I think you can see some of the hyperbole in his his rhetorical style. Clearly trying to say, look how horrible I was, yet God saved even me. I made my way through. And in some sense, he may be trying to say, don't you guys go there, because you know, you'll end up back with God anyway. Avoid the agony of this whirlpool of sin. And so he's really presenting himself as the most horrible of all creatures. And
my daughter's 11. I won't tell stories so much on her, except to say that her conscience, she has what she calls rocks. And the rocks are the things that go into the pit of her stomach when she has a thought, that she doesn't like the thought. And we have this process where we kind of go, and that's real. And to somehow deny her rock and say, no, you don't really feel that.
Yeah.
I had some Mormon guys come and visit me one day, and somehow the conversation got to around original sin, and they said something about, oh, you're not that bad a person, and I just looked at them and said, you have no idea, and then I kind of enjoyed that maybe too much, but to look at somebody else and say, you're not such a bad person, when the conscience, if that's what he's experiencing. And is there a theology, is there a God who can go that far into the depths and still find value in me or not? That's the question that Augustine grabs hold of.
Right, and he wants to tell you, yes.
Because otherwise I have to make excuses, otherwise I have to blame somebody else, otherwise I have to try to rearrange how I'm feeling, how I'm thinking, and how God works, and God really can't get that far down. And so I think that's, you know, he just gets down there and says, if this is where I'm at, can God find me here? And the answer he comes to is yes.
Right, so it's a particular description of the human condition, which not all religions nor all Christians buy, about the depth of the human capacity for sin. But Augustine definitely believes that and wants to say, even so, God will meet you there. God will bring you out of it. Did you want to jump in?
Yeah, what I was going to say is to reflect upon the way what he was saying was he really reflected a level of depth about his understanding of his sexual drive. Because he said that what he was lacking in this was that he had the surface level of sexual attraction, and that in doing so he missed the true love of the right. You know, of the individual. So it was only the bodily the bodily drive that he was attending to, not to the depth of attachment to the person that he was having the sex with.
Yeah.
And then the other allusion about it was because he was saying, it talks about the intellectual, so it might very well have been a homosexual, because the education of females was probably, his mother probably was, but culturally there probably wasn't an equality of education, so it might have been a homosexual that he was struggling with.
Yeah, I don't think we know how he expressed his sexuality, except that he definitely had this concubine who, by all accounts, he seemed to have been loyal to. But he definitely seems to, at least from his own description, to be someone who was really, you know, taken over by his own sexual desire. And I think, again, if you read this as a teaching book, you know, remember this was written by a bishop, and certainly he didn't realize back when he was having sex that, well, what I really want is love, but I'm expressing it in the form of lust, and he saw that in retrospect, and he's trying to help people who are in the middle of it to identify their own desires as misplaced, you know, and to say what you really want, what your heart most desires, is God. And you will not find any kind of happiness. And he says, we all seek for happiness. We just don't know how to get there. And so he's using his own life to teach us where we can find it.
Yeah. Well, it just sounds a lot like kind of these, what I would now call a bit of scare tactics that were used against people, younger people, when I was growing up. And this wasn't uber fundamentalist Christianity. It was just slightly conservative end of Christianity. And I think what I've seen now in some of my friends is that kind of attitude about sexuality has led to such a fear of sexuality because of getting caught up in a whirlpool that they can't develop intimate relationships with people. And so I think it's a really touchy topic when you fear sex that much, that it's such a whirlpool that you can't get out of it, and that there's no expression of sexuality that might be somewhere in the middle of a healthy mutuality, that you then are so scared of it that you never enter into it, or you allow yourself only to be taken over by it in some problematic ways. So,
yeah, and I think that's one of the criticisms of Augustine, is that he is so derogatory about sex and the body, and part of that has to do with, you know, the fact that he did see his life in the monastic life as a higher commitment, which is total abstinence. But even here he says, you know, why didn't my mother marry me off? You know, why didn't they encourage me to go get married? And he says it's because they wanted me to be successful. But if I had only gotten married, then my desires would have had a focal point, and then the children would have come along, and this would have been, you know, I would have, my energies would have been directed. But still, you know, then he wouldn't have been Augustine. And so again, he asks all these questions like, why did they do this? Why didn't they do that? Why did God let me this? But in the end, he wants to say, because God was there all the time and you know, not necessarily guiding him directly, but leading him to who he was and would be. So yeah, the sexuality thing is a problem. But let me just point to one more thing in this book, and I don't know if any of you have heard one of the iconic stories from Augustine's life, which is, maybe we can call it the pear tree incident.
Yeah.
Does anyone know of that?
Yeah, it's better than sex.
Do you want to tell it in, you know, three minutes or less?
No, it's best read, I think.
He tells it in a few sentences here, really, and then he circles back to assess what is going on here. And here it is. There was a pear tree near our vineyard, loaded with fruit, that was attractive neither to look at nor to taste. Late one night, a band of ruffians, myself included, went off to shake down the fruit and carry it away, for we had continued our games outdoors until well after dark, as was our pernicious habit. We took away an enormous quantity of pears, not to eat them ourselves, but simply to throw them to the pigs. Perhaps we ate some of them, but our real pleasure consisted in doing something that was forbidden. This is the great pear tree incident. I'm going to talk about that quite a bit tomorrow because it has to do with his whole assessment of what sin is, what desire we are aiming for when we commit a sin. And he questions, he has a whole series again of questions, why did I do this? What was my aim? The fruit didn't look good. You know, it wasn't that I wanted the fruit. I didn't want the pigs to have the fruit. Why, if I had been by myself, I would certainly wouldn't have done it because it wasn't fun, something fun to do by yourself. Why did I do this? And so he turns this whole thing into an assessment of what was I after? What good was I seeking? And why did I do such a heinous act of destruction? And again, you think, okay, he ripped off a bunch of pears, whatever. But apparently, he felt like, and again, you have to read this story in particular in light of the fact that he's writing as a bishop. And you can read all kinds of biblical imagery into the story, et cetera, in the end. But let me just read a bit of his assessment in this book. It's in section 8, the last sentence, and then a little bit into section 9. Here's what he says. You know, he's had a whole series of was it this, was it that, maybe that. Now he says, as it was not the fruit that gave me pleasure, I must have got it from the crime itself, from the thrill of having partners in sin. We were tickled to laughter by the prank we had played because no one suspected us of it, although the owners were furious. Why was it then that I thought it fun not to have been the only culprit? Perhaps it was because we do not easily laugh when we are alone. True enough, but even when a man is all by himself and quite alone, sometimes he cannot help laughing if he thinks or hears or sees something especially funny. All the same, I am quite sure that I would never have done this on my own. So, in the end, his assessment of this story, at least in part, and he returns to it later in the text too, is that he knows he's seeking some good. And he tries out all these answers. What was the good I seek? And it seems like, at least part of the conclusion is, it's companionship. It's getting together and laughing and doing something fun together. He never would have done it alone. What he's trying to do here is give us a picture of the human heart, the restless heart. What do we seek? What was I seeking in such a destructive act? I wanted companionship. I wanted friendship. And this is another great theme in Augustine, which he was very passionate about, his friends. But he's describing us as always looking for the good. What will make us feel fulfilled? And companionship is certainly something that human beings crave and need. They want to feel together, they want to feel part of something as a team. And even this destructive evil act gave them that sense, briefly, but then, you know, at least in this retrospect, he feels regret and horror at himself for thinking that this was a great idea, and he's totally humiliated by it, yet he's telling us about it. You know, would you tell, what's your pear tree incident? Let's have it. Tell us about the worst thing you've done. the thing that made you feel so horrible and humiliated. He's telling us because he wants to say, look, I did all this stuff. God still saved me. Are there moments like that in your life?
Well, I think it's also very pastoral to tell a story that's, you know, something that you've done that's wrong and that you now recognize. And, you know, I've heard that from preaching professors. Yeah. Like, if you're going to give an example of yourself, it better be a negative example, because if you give a good example of how wonderful you are and how pious you are, like, that is totally unhelpful and comes across ridiculous to people listening to you, you know? So I think in some sense it's very pastoral to recognize, like, an incident that was, that he now recognizes as, you know, not so great. But in the other sense, it, I mean, especially that he started the story with the pears weren't really that good to eat, or, like, you know, so
there's no
appeal. Were the people actually eating those pears? You know, like, is it really, like, I was just kind of like, were they really upset? Like, was it really, like, they weren't even good pears, and therefore, like, it's just kids, you know, mucking around or whatever. But so it's just interesting to hear.
Yeah, I mean, the event itself doesn't seem that bad, but he turns it into a story about the human condition. You know, the waste, what was the point of that? And the point of it was there's some other good they were seeking, and they thought they could get it through this destructive vandalism. And that's, you kids do that. Like, let's go egg the neighbor's house. It's fun because it creates a sense of community. And that's a good, and Augustine always wants to talk about the good of friendship and the good of companionship, and that we need that. But it's when it's the end, and it doesn't matter what we do to get there, that it becomes a problem. And it is, again, I think that's absolutely right. It's a pastoral act to say, here I am, this is what I've done. I can't justify it at all, but this is why I did it. I was seeking the good. And I was seeking it in the wrong places. He does a lot more with the story, but it's his way, again, of describing the restless heart. We're looking around. What can we do to feel a part of something? And I won't read you my last quote because it's 5:15.
I have a question. You said that he was influential in the church with the idea of original sin. And it was about that time, as I understand it, the early 400s, that the idea of worshiping Mary along with Jesus came into being. And because of his background, was he influential in that also?
Oh, gosh, I have...
And celibacy along with that, Mary and celibacy.
I don't know. I don't know if I've ever read anything by Augustine that talks about Mary. I mean, I certainly haven't read all of Augustine's works, but I can't answer that. I don't know the answer.
He would have written about it if it were important to him.
Yeah. I mean, it is true that I meant what I said about this, you know, Monica being a central part of his life and interpreted by him as the voice of God. So I don't think he would have, you know, rejected the notion of Mary playing a bigger role, but I don't know that he was central. All right. Thanks for coming.
You can read your last.
I can read the last, but we don't have to rush off. Okay, it sort of sums up, and it's short. This is his conclusion. So the soul defiles itself with unchaste love when it turns away from you and looks elsewhere for things which it cannot find pure and unsullied except by returning to you. He's talking again to God. All who desert you and set themselves up against you merely copy you in a perverse way. But by this very act of imitation, they only show that you are the creator of all nature and consequently that there is no place whatever where man may hide away from you. So despite all our efforts to find the good elsewhere, we're not going to end up stuck there. God will not let us hide in some other love.
One of my favorite professors last year, as we were working through some of Augustine's theology, I'm reminded of something, of the refrain that he kept coming back to as you're reading these. Every so often, as we're going through the theology, he'd be like, he'd stop and say, Gus, relax, have a scotch.
It's true. I mean, it reminds me of the intensity that you read in Luther of, you know, they're so intent at finding the right path. And in a sense, Augustine's talking to himself here to say, look, it's all going to be good. You know, just relax and enjoy the ride in some ways. Because he does seem very intense.
When we got to Luther, he said, Martin, have a double.
That's a good one. All right, so maybe I'll see you, some of you, later in the week. And thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.